Okay, I'd like to call the meeting to order. And good afternoon to everybody. And we'd just like to announce that this meeting will be held in accordance with House Rule 10.01, which was passed and allowing for online meetings. And what I'd like to do now is have the clerk call the roll. Laura, do you want to call the roll?
Yep.
Did you hear me?
Yeah, I'm going to unmute everyone.
Matt, they're going to do a call. You want to call now? I got to go.
Just for the benefit of members, we're told that you know, normally when you go into committee, the clerk checks people off. But being that we're online, they're asking that so there is a record of who's present that we actually call the roll. So, Laura, whenever you're ready.
Representative Carlson.
Who is that?
Chair Carlson.
Present.
Representative Olson.
Present.
Representative Garofalo.
Yes, I'm present. Sorry.
Representative Albright.
Present.
Representative Bernardi.
Present.
Representative Davids. Representative Dabney. Representative Druskowski.
Here.
Representative Eklund.
Present.
Representative Hamilton.
Present.
Representative Hansen.
Here.
Representative Hausman.
Present.
Representative Hertas. Representative Hornstein.
Present.
Representative Kreisha.
Present.
Representative Liebling. Representative Lilly.
Present.
Representative Long.
Present.
Representative Mariani. Representative Marquardt.
Present.
Representative Nelson.
Present.
Representative Neuer.
Present.
Representative Pawlowski.
Present.
Representative Poppy.
Present.
Representative Schumacher. Representative Scott.
Here.
Representative Torkelson.
Present.
Representative Vogel.
Present.
Representative Wagenius.
Here.
There is a quorum present.
Okay. With the quorum being present, I've got a couple of announcements, Dan, and then we'll begin. Meeting and proceedings are open to the public. And as I mentioned, we are being taped. And like in a regular committee meeting, all conversations should go through the chair. And we did point out when we had a training session the other day, although not everybody was on, at the bottom of your screen there, if you want to be recognized, there's the blue hand, and you hit that button, and then I'll be able to see who wants to be recognized. When we begin the testimony, the way I'd like to proceed, however, and we'd often do this regular committee meeting, is that we'll allow the two testifiers to complete their testimony, and then we'll go to questions. So that's the way we'll choose to operate. And our two presenters today are Commissioner Dr. Columbakidis and also Commissioner Franz. Now, he was going to join us a little late. I don't know if he's on yet or not. Dr. Kalambakidis was going to start. So why don't we go to the testimony, and Dr. Kalambakidis, if you want to give us an update on the state of the economy.
Sure. Thank you, Chair Carlson. Thank you, members of the committee. Glad to be here today. As you know, on Friday, was it? We released our quarterly revenue and economic update. And that was according to our usual schedule, where we provide an update of the U.S. economic outlook and an update of revenues. I'm going to start with a few points about the U.S. economic outlook. So the outlook for near-term U.S. economic growth, as measured by real GDP, which is usually how we present it, has, of course, dramatically weakened since we released our February forecast. And that's due, of course, to the outbreak of COVID-19 and the measures taken to prevent its spread. Our macroeconomic consulting firm, IHS Markit, is now forecasting a 5.4% contraction in real GDP in 2020. So that's negative growth of 5.4%. And that's compared, not that it's particularly relevant now, but that's compared to 2.1% that they were forecasting in the February outlook. So that contraction occurs as consumers are unable to spend due to temporary business closures and due to stay-at-home orders and due to new unemployment. Remember that I've said in the past that consumer spending was the engine of the economic expansion that we were in, the longest ever economic expansion. And so the measures that have been taken to slow the spread of COVID-19 and the disease itself have made it more difficult for consumers to spend. And then that contraction is further plagued by a collapse in oil prices. So this is, again, a contraction at the U.S. level, not talking about Minnesota specifically yet. Collapse in oil prices, shutdown of auto manufacturing, volatile financial markets, rising unemployment, and this year IHS is forecasting a global recession. And so slower growth in our trading partners slows growth for the United States. The April outlook, it was released on the 2nd of the month. It includes the impact of the $2.3 trillion federal coronavirus aid relief and economic security act, so the CARES Act. IHS characterizes the CARES Act as a modest stimulus that will provide a small offset to the effects of the suspension of economic activity. What IHS expects going forward is that they caution that all of this forecast and any subsequent forecast is highly uncertain because it depends very much on how the virus spreads and how the pandemic itself plays out. So they have to make assumptions about what they think is going to happen with regard to the disease itself. So they expect the spread of COVID-19 to peak and then dissipate in the second calendar quarter of this year, so the middle of this year, allowing social distancing restrictions to be lifted during the third quarter. And then economic recovery begins in the third quarter of the year, and real GDP growth turns positive in the fourth quarter. Real GDP growth in 21 is projected at 6.3%. So for this year, we're well below trend growth. We're in a contraction according to this forecast. And then next year, there's an acceleration. The increased growth that is expected next year shouldn't be seen as then, and then we get back to normal, because it's enough of a decline this year that even with the increased growth next year, we don't catch back up to where we would have been in the absence of the pandemic. A couple of things about the outlook. I said that IHS points out themselves that their outlook depends critically on the path of the disease. And so not just this outlook is uncertain, but subsequent outlooks that they will produce are also uncertain. Another measure of uncertainty here is that in our revenue and economic update, we always compare what IHS Market is saying to the blue chip consensus of 50 macroeconomic forecasting firms. And the range of forecasted growth for 2020 among the blue chip 50 it's a much larger range than it normally is. And so that in itself is a sign of uncertainty about the near-term outlook. And then as you all are familiar, IHS Market assigns a subjective probability to their baseline outlook, and then they assign additional probabilities to a more pessimistic and a more optimistic outlook. They've assigned a 45% probability to the April baseline outlook, and that's a pretty low probability for the baseline. So that's just another measure of uncertainty and volatility in the U.S. economic outlook. It has changed dramatically since February. It's even a dramatic change since their March outlook. And so we should expect the U.S. outlook to remain unsettled for a while. Now let me move to a couple of points about our revenue story. One thing that you'll notice about the revenue story, and you will have noticed if you already read the report, is that because there's a lag in revenue data, that creates an apparent disconnect between the economic outlook and the revenue story. So we aren't seeing yet as dramatic a change in revenue collections as what we're seeing in the U.S. outlook. So what we reported on Friday is that Minnesota General Fund revenues during the months of February and March 2020 this year, and we compared those to our February forecast. General Fund receipts for February and March were $103 million, less than projected in the February outlook. And receipts for the individual income tax, the sales tax, and other revenues were below forecast. The corporate receipts were ahead of the February forecast. And the short story is that the shortfall reflects several things. It reflects the pace of income tax refund processing. So we think that income tax refunds, which are for tax year 19, are being processed faster than what we had expected in the February outlook. And so that lowers receipts relative to what we had expected at this time, but that doesn't necessarily reflect a lower tax year 19 tax liability. It also reflects payment delays. So you know that there have been the Minnesota Department of Revenue has allowed taxpayers to delay paying their tax year 19 income tax bills until July 15th. And you know that sales tax firms that remit sales taxes have been allowed to delay remittance of sales taxes. But in addition to those things, the shortfall also does reflect the beginning of the impact of deteriorating economic conditions on state revenues. So it's the beginning of the story. It's not the whole story. Individual income tax receipts during February and March were $101 million less than forecast. The income tax withholding payments, that's withholding on individual income taxes during the current year. So that's something that we usually look to reflect current year activity. Those were $5 million lower than forecast. We know that unemployment insurance claims for unemployment insurance benefits have surged since the middle of March. And so the $5 million shortfall in income tax withholding doesn't reflect the full impact of those new unemployed people. Every unemployment insurance claim means less withholding. And so we do expect the cumulative shortfall to grow as the impact of new unemployment makes its way through business payrolls. But it's not obvious how much that might fall, how much the cumulative impact might be, because there's it's not a a systematic reduction in employment across all wage groups, across all industries, across all occupations. And there are differential effects. And so we're going to try to keep an eye on that. I mentioned the refunds for tax year 19 are ahead of forecast, and we think that's due to faster processing and not necessarily related to tax year 19 liability. Also related to tax year 19 liability are the final payments and payments that come in with income tax extensions that usually come in April 15th. Those, of course, many of those will be delayed because people are allowed to delay those. And so when we get our May revenue information, it will be incomplete relative to what we usually see at the beginning of May. So usually at the beginning of May, we can get a pretty good picture of what the previous tax year liability was. And that's not going to be true this time because there will be delays and we won't know exactly how much people have delayed. So that's one of the ways that the signals that we normally use when we're estimating what's going on in the economy, what's going on in tax revenues, those signals are both delayed and muddied and less clear than they usually are. Regarding sales taxes, we've got an unclear signal there as well. Sales tax receipts were $14 million below the forecast. And we estimate, that was net sales tax receipts. But if you look at gross sales tax receipts, so just receipts without consideration of refunds, gross sales tax receipts in March, which reflects February activity, February sales. So gross sales tax receipts in March reflecting February sales were $51 million below the forecast. And currently we estimate that about $50 million of that was due to firms identified in Executive Order 2004 delaying remittance of those sales taxes as they were allowed to do. So there's this, with regard to sales taxes, there's delay both in that 1 month's receipts reflects the previous month's sales, but now we have a delay also administratively in the time that firms are required to remit the sales taxes. And that delay, that opportunity to delay for those firms has now been extended until May. Corporate tax receipts are ahead of the forecast by $22 million. Corporate tax receipts are our most volatile revenue source. And corporations have complicated tax circumstances. A lot of these are big multinational corporations. And so we do ultimately expect corporate receipts to fall below forecast as corporate profits fall below our forecast. But it's the toughest revenue source to forecast. So I will end it there, and I'm happy to take questions, or if Commissioner France is on, I can pass it to him for initial comments.
He was part of a press conference and would be a little bit late, so he's now with us. So, Commissioner, did you have anything that you'd like to say at this point?
I think it would be best to open it up for questions. I was listening to the last several minutes to Dr. Columbakidis's review of the April 10th the revenue and economic update. So I can talk about some other topics, but I thought maybe if there's any questions, this might be a good time to ask those questions, if that's okay with you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, I'm trying to get the list up here now. I had it a little bit ago.
Can you hear me okay?
Let's see. Representative Hornstein has a question. Yes, we can hear you.
All right, thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and Commissioner or Ms. Columbakidis. Do you have yet any kind of estimate as to what you anticipate our deficit may be moving into the future? Do you have enough data? And if not, when might you have some projections on that? I'm assuming we have a deficit.
Right. Let's just jump right into it. All right. No, that's a good question, Representative. I think the key question that Dr. Columbakidis has talked about a number of times in the last several months is making sure that we have the right data to make that determination. We do not know from a budget projection point of view whether we're in a deficit or not. Now, we obviously can see the data like everybody else can, and so we have our assumptions. So that's one of the things the governor has asked MMB to do between now and the first part of May, is to put together a budget projection. So most of you all know, maybe some people on the call don't know, but the normal process obviously is every November and February we do a forecast. And during the forecast is when Dr. Columbakidis gives us the revenue projections and economic forecast. And then we also turn around and provide you with a budget projection at the same time. But the statute does provide for budget projections at any time. And so our assumption is that we need to make some best guesses in the next 3 to 4 weeks about where we are and try to provide the best possible budget projection in early May. Now, it wouldn't be a forecast. We do think we'll probably need more time to get more data to do a complete forecast. You don't want to do a forecast until you have the numbers, right? You want to make it really worthwhile. So I think the goal right now for the governor's assets is to prepare for this for the legislature. So before May 18th rolls around, early May, we want to provide the legislature with an updated budget projection. Now, at that point, we may be projecting a deficit or not, and we'll just have to wait and see. But so we don't know yet. We assume that we likely are, or we're headed in that direction. We think we'll have more information or enough information to do a budget projection by the 1st of May. I should say the first part of May, not May 1.
Thank you.
Sure.
Commissioner, as I mentioned to you in an earlier conversation, I listened to you on Almanac, and it sounded like at some point in the future, there might be some interest in doing a formal forecast. That sounds a little different than what we're talking about now. And you did indicate you would want to have a pretty good handle on what the revenue was, with people having the opportunity to pay their taxes later and so on. Any idea between yourself or the Dr. Columbakidis in terms of when we could have an earlier forecast? The reason that I ask that is that time, when if we were to have a deficit, becomes a precious commodity. Because the earlier you begin to do things, whether it's on the revenue side or on the expenditure side, things are sometimes a little more practical than if you get closer and closer to the end of the fiscal year of the biennium.
Well, let me take a stab at it, Mr. Chair, then I'll turn it over to Dr. Columbakidis, and she can tell you a little bit about what are those things, what's that data, what does she want to know, and how will that help her inform us get a better forecast? But for in terms of what we're talking about now, clearly the idea is that we want to provide the legislature an opportunity to see our best estimate as we know it in May about where we are with the budget projection. That's clearly going to change over time. And one of the things that I just got off the call, as you mentioned, Mr. Chair, with the governor about a press conference about all these issues, the stay-at-home order, how long is it going to last? How are we going to start bringing back businesses? Under what time frame? The answer to every one of those questions really decides what the data is going to look like in some ways, because we can't really predict really very well when is the economy going to recover, when are things going to start turning around, because we don't know how long the stay-at-home order and those kinds of orders are going to be in place both here and around the country. So anyway, so that's why we do think it's incumbent upon us to provide the best guess we can, and it's going to be a guess, obviously, in May. But I'll let Dr. Columbakidis talk about what it is about a forecast that makes it more difficult and why you need better data. Dr. Columbakidis?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, so that we use the U.S. Economic Outlook to inform our forecasts. And we use Minnesota-specific data on employment, withholding, personal income to inform our economic forecast of Minnesota. So we use the U.S. information and we use Minnesota information. We use those two things together to forecast Minnesota's economic data that is necessary to produce our revenue forecast. And in addition, we use what we know about current revenues. So at the moment, every one of those pieces of information is either more volatile than usual or delayed and muddied. And so it's a tough time to try to provide a full forecast, a full look at that would be with the same level of accuracy and confidence that we normally have. At the same time, we are well aware of how important it is for the legislature and for the agencies and for the governor to have the best information possible about what is probably coming down the pike for Minnesota and what our budget situation is going to look like. And so in this interim budget projection, we are going to do everything we can with the information we have to produce a projection that we can have as much confidence about as possible regarding what's coming next. One of the reasons that what we're working on is not a full forecast is because one of the things has to do with the amount of data that we don't have. Another is that in the time frame and that we're working in, we probably will not be, this projection will not probably benefit from our full modeling capabilities. We use everything we can, but there are some things that we might not be able to get to in terms of running models. And another reason that it's different is that we're just looking at the current biennium. So you all know from looking at our February and November forecasts over time that when we project into the planning estimate years, so this time would be 22 and 23, those come with more uncertainty, much more uncertainty, that it's very hard to project the economy that far out. And right now, it really would not make a lot of sense to project further out. So what happens in the next couple of weeks as we're working, next few weeks as we're working on this and trying to aim for something useful at the beginning of in early May is we, every week, we get new and additional income tax withholding data. And that helps us to see how the current employment situation, about which we don't have much data, we know about new unemployment insurance claims, but we don't yet have new Minnesota employment data. But the withholding data gives us some idea of how the employment situation is feeding through the tax system. And so that's new information that we'll have. We will have incrementally more information about sales tax receipts, but as I said, that's going to be difficult to interpret because of the delays. But also by the beginning of May or end of April, we will have information on estimated tax payments, quarterly estimated tax payments for this, the current year. And so that's helpful because both that and withholding give us some, give us a bit of a picture of what might be going on in Minnesota's economy. So that's where we are, and you can trust that we will do our best to provide information that is as timely as it can be, and also as useful as it can be.
Okay, thank you. Just a reminder to members: if you have a question, want to be recognized at the bottom of the screen, there's the blue hand, and you just press that button. And then that lets me know who has a question who would like to be recognized. At this point, I don't think I've got anybody that's raised their... Oh, yeah, here we go. Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Appreciate it. And also thank you both to Commissioner Franz and others for being present today. I want to be brief. Hopefully all members will avoid their third reading speeches today and we can just have questions. But Commissioner Franz, I know you've been exceptionally busy. You got a lot going on, but if you could, there's a lot of stuff floating around about emergency powers, black helicopters telling Minnesotans that the powers the governor has and doesn't have. Can you just briefly outline how the emergency powers are started and then outline the process by which they're terminated?
Let me unmute.
That was directed to the commissioner. Commissioner Franz?
There we go. Can you hear me now?
Yes, we can.
Thank you, Representative Garofalo and Mr. Chair, for the question. So the process, as you referred to, is laid out in statute, and it's pretty clear that the process gives the governor, the legislature wrote the statute to give the governor the authority to declare a peacetime emergency, and he can do that for 5 days, and then the executive council needs to approve an extension beyond that to 30 days. But beyond 30 days, then the power shifts to the legislature. And so under the statute, the legislature has the power to terminate a peacetime emergency if both bodies, both chambers, vote in the negatives or vote to end the emergency powers. So that statute provides that if the legislature is not in session, that the governor must call or shall call a special session to allow that to occur. So many of you will know that this morning the governor just issued a executive order 2035, where he is extending the COVID-19 peacetime emergency for another 30 days. So with that, I'll just read a couple things from that because I think it lays out the procedure quite well. So the governor determined that the threat of COVID-19 pandemic is continuing in nature, and he's declared that he must continue the peacetime declaration for another 30 days. Now, the peacetime emergency that was declared initially will now be extended until May 13. And because the legislature is currently in session, regular session, there's no need to call the legislature into a special session because the legislature has the ability and authority to vote on the extension of that peacetime emergency now during its regular session. So that is how it works while the legislature is in session. So this will expire on May 13th, as I mentioned. So on May 13th, if the governor decides that there needs to be another extension of that, then once again, the legislature would be in session and would have the opportunity and authority to determine if both houses agree, they could determine to end the peacetime emergency. It takes a majority vote in both chambers. Then the question becomes what happens after May 18th, and assuming that the legislature is not in session after that point, and the governor has been working with the legislative leaders to come up with a process that everyone, I think, agrees would provide the best opportunity for the legislature to stay engaged and involved in that process. I think I will say, as a lawyer, that the statute is poorly drafted just in terms of the way it operates. And so it's somewhat ambiguous, and there's been some different interpretations of what that ambiguity means. But I think in the interest of resolving the ambiguity in a way that provides the best coordination and cooperation with the executive branch and the legislative branch, the governor would then, if after May 18th, the governor decided that the peacetime emergency needed to be extended beyond whatever date that was in June, then he shall call the legislature back into special session to give them the opportunity to either to affirmatively stop the peacetime order if they so chose. And then I think that's a process that the leaders all agreed that they would continue to do that on a regular basis. If that occurred, that the governor would always call back the legislature to have that opportunity to exercise legislative oversight. Like I said, the statute's unclear sort of how it's supposed to work, but during the process between May 18th and the next regular session, this provides the opportunity for the legislature and the governor to work together to make sure that there's an agreement about the peacetime order. So I think that sort of outlines the process as I understand it.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Commissioner. Thank you. And I'm very glad to hear you say that, of course, we all want this to end as soon as possible, but the reality is the virus is going to dictate a lot of our responses to this. And so I'm very glad to hear that the administration has taken the view, because as you said, the language is poorly drafted. And one of the many things we need to do is clean that up at some point in the future.
Right.
But I'm glad to hear that in the event that there's a need for the emergency to go beyond sine die, that the legislature will be given an opportunity to weigh on that. So thank you, Commissioner. That's good news. If you could, for a moment, I think that there's a there's a misunderstanding between the emergency declaration and the executive orders that the governor is issuing. Can you just, again, for not only the public, but also for members, just explain the difference between the emergency declaration and the executive order?
Sure, Representative and Mr. Chair. I think the key was that when the governor declared the peacetime emergency on March 13, 2020, Executive Order 20-01, he did not exercise any of the powers that are enumerated that the governor has under the peacetime emergency declaration. The goal at that time, I believe that was Friday the 13th, if I recall, the goal at that time was to let everyone know that we clearly are entering a peacetime emergency with the COVID-19 situation, and that he intended to let people know that he was going to start exercising those powers. And in fact, it was, I believe it was that Sunday, I think it was Sunday, the March 15th, that he issued the order about the schools, closing the schools. So he wanted to make sure that he has to have the reason to issue declare the peacetime emergency, and it's the statute that then provides him with the authority to engage in peacetime powers underneath that declaration. So I don't have all the enumerated powers in front of me, but it's from the basis of the declaration comes the powers that the governor issues on an ongoing basis in conjunction with the declaration of the peacetime emergency. So it's the emergency declaration that gives him the authority to issue the orders in the short term.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Chairman and Commissioner, thank you again for that. I appreciate you outlining the difference between the emergency declaration and the executive orders that are given. As you can understand, there's a lot of Minnesotans who, right now, there's a lot of concern. And there is a genuine concern and fear about so many decisions being made by one person. Certainly, it's not a criticism of the person or even the decisions that are being made, but we're all Americans, and Americans don't like being told what to do. And so the concern of that sort of centralization and consolidation of power, whether the decisions are popular or not, it's very concerning to many Minnesotans. And I just, on behalf of the people I represent, I want to make sure that I voice those concerns to you. Hopefully the governor, someone came up with a beautiful analogy earlier today. They said, you know, it seems like sometimes the governor views this as a flight and he just wants the plane to keep flying forever. And then someone else suggested that, well, that's better than the alternative. Some people are proposing we just crash the plane right now. And I would hope that we all recognize that there are many other choices before us besides flying the plane indefinitely or crashing the plane into the side of a mountain. So, last question for you, Commissioner, and that is with regards to the items you talked about regarding the budget. We have obviously a budget situation that is without historical precedent. You've mentioned earlier that there are variables at play in terms of how much revenue goes down, how much expenditures go up as more people qualify for programs, how much federal assistance is made available, how much our local cities and counties, how much they're requesting from us to help them out. Can you just lay out a time frame for us? Members that have contacted me have been concerned about the constitutional deadline for when the regular session ends, but also recognizing the need to balance the budget, that we can't borrow money like the federal government, that we have a constitutional obligation to balance the budget. Can you just map out, understanding that you'll have flexibility in this, but can you please just map out a tentative schedule or timeline for when we can be looking at updated information, budget recommendations, budget changes, debate and implementation? Can you just map that out as you see it right now, based on the information you have now for the rest of this calendar year?
Sure, Representative, Mr. Chair, glad to do that. You know, it is a little hard. As you mentioned, none of us have done this before. And I think one of the keys for us is to make sure that we do it in a methodical, precise way. We don't want to overreact and we don't want to underreact, right? So I think the key right now is between now and the 1st of May, first of all, as Dr. Klumbeke just mentioned, we're going to get some more economic data that will be helpful. And then number two, we're also within the next week or so, we're going to be getting both guidance from the federal government and money from the federal government that we can use to deploy to for some of the expenditures that we've been already engaged in and some more expenditures that we want to continue. So we believe that that combination of more economic data in the next 3 or 4 weeks, the information about what the federal funds can be used for and how will they be how will our expenses be reimbursed. But we've also, you shouldn't be surprised, have been talking to agencies about their current spending patterns, what's going on, what's different, what's usual, what changes do they see coming over the next 3 or 4 weeks. So the goal is to have the first sort of check-in, if you will, have this budget projection in early May be that first check-in about, okay, here's our best guess in terms of where we are with the biennial budget that we had, given the current situation, given the federal dollars, where do we think we are over the next 16 or 14 months? And so we want to give that to the legislature while you're still in session. But I don't think this is going to be the last, it will definitely not be the last time we do this sort of a thing, because think about it. Because really in early May is probably, and I'm just guessing, I don't know, is probably when some of these restrictions are going to start changing around the country and maybe in Minnesota, depending how things are going. So that's going to change by direct connection, going to change our projection of revenues and jobs and what's happening. So I really anticipate that over the course of the summer and this fall, there are going to be a number of opportunities where we're going to need to check in and say, okay, well, what we told you in May, that's changed because the revenue stream has changed, the spending has changed, and guess what? We got less or more federal money. So I really wanted the legislature to realize that we view this as an ongoing dialogue, that even we're not feeling like we need to wrap everything up and get it finalized forever by May 18th. Our goal is that with this budget projection in early May, we'll talk about it. We'll see what we should do in the short term. But I just don't think we're going to have the vision or the data to decide that until next January. So my assumption will be is that there'll be ongoing discussions with this committee and other committees, and the legislature may or may not be in session with the ongoing declaration of emergency, or we may just call you back for special sessions regarding budget issues. So I view this as an ongoing dialogue because we need to make sure that it's important for the state of Minnesota that the legislature and the executive work together to get this figured out because, you know, we're trying to save lives, number one, right? Pretty serious. Trying to save lives. And we're trying to also make sure that the government structure is there to help the economy get going again. One of the things we have to be careful about, we don't want to overreact and do things that pull back the kind of support services that businesses are going to want and need in May and June when they're coming back online. So that's the delicate balance that I think we're going to need to have some flexibility. We're going to have to trust one another to give some flexibility, but always provide that opportunity for insight and communication back and forth. So I see it as an ongoing dialogue beginning, now, obviously, and continuing throughout the rest of this year. I mean, I hope things settle off. And by July or August, we've got it all figured out. Well, if that happens, well, great for us, but it might not. So that's a long-winded way, I'm sorry, of saying that I do think it's going to be an ongoing process. Our goal is let's make our first cut at this in May, see what we think about it, see what we want to do, and then check in throughout the summer and this fall. I think that's what's going to have to happen.
Okay, the next person is Representative Pawlowski. He called in. Representative Pawlowski.
On what happens after session ends. So, Commissioner, after session ends and we are now no longer in the regular session, under what circumstances would we have to come back for a special session or a series of special sessions to balance the budget? And I have a follow-up after that dealing with what the governor can do to balance the budget when we are not in either special session or regular session.
Well, Representative and Mr. Chair, you know, I think the statute provides a lot of flexibility in terms of how we manage, because the statute, I think, anticipates that deficits occur outside of session and decisions need to be made fairly quickly sometimes. So the statute provides the authority, if there is a deficit determined this summer, let's say, for example, to access the reserves and use the reserves to rebalance the budget. But I think from a realistic point of view, because of all the different issues that are going on both in terms of the emergency nature of this situation with emergency orders and declaration of the emergency, but there'll be plenty of things to talk about. So I don't know under what conditions that would happen. I just know that even though there's authority to make to rebalance the budget through the statutory use of the reserve, if there's a deficit projected by a budget projection, that we can solve that deficit at least temporarily. But I would imagine that if things get really significant and concerning, we would want to consult with the legislature. But I can't anticipate what those situations are at this point.
Mr. Chair?
Then
I have a follow-up. During the CUI years, there were a succession of special sessions to balance the budget. It would appear that we would anticipate during this cycle that it is likely over the summer and fall that we would have perhaps a series of special sessions to balance the budget, either because we are in deficit or because there is an anticipation of some type of revenue, perhaps from the federal government. Would that be a true statement?
Commissioner?
Representative, Mr. Chair, well, I think that the we anticipate, obviously, federal revenues within the next 10 days, obviously, and there may be more, as you suggest, there could be more. And we do need to have the legislative authorization to use those funds going forward. You know, we've worked out a pretty interesting process thus far on the Minnesota COVID, COVID-19 Minnesota Fund, the $200 million. We have a process in place here where there are five leaders from the House and five leaders from the Senate that provide approval or disapproval of expenditures over $1 million in that fund. And there's been, I forget, maybe like 10 or so requests made already. And virtually every single one of those requests has been answered within a matter of hours and provided that direction. So there are all kinds of different mechanisms that we can use that engage the legislature to be involved in the appropriation of funds. But you're correct in the sense that additional federal funding will require some legislative appropriation process. I mean, there is a legislative advisory commission process that's there too. So, it depends. I just don't know enough to know whether the deficit we're going to see will go beyond the $2.359 billion that we currently have in the reserve or not. I just don't know what that looks like. So if you have some suggestions, I'm happy to hear them.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Pulaski.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner, I have one last question, and it does revolve around this. We exhaust our reserves. We exhaust the cash flow. There is no federal stimulus to help us. Then we would be in a situation where we would have to be called into special session. Is that correct?
Commissioner.
Representative, Mr. Chair, that sounds correct to me. I have to tell you, I haven't thought through that scenario quite yet, but you're right. That could be a scenario where we would need to call in the legislature.
Mr. Chair, I raised the question because of the size of the numbers that we're looking at, both in this state and collecting revenue, and then with the number of people who are on unemployment. We're looking at really a twofold impact here. One is we won't be collecting as much revenue, and yet we are going to be having a great deal of revenue going out. Plus, it's going to be a national cycle. It's going to be hitting us. So I'm just stating that I would anticipate that the legislature would have to be called into session at least once or twice, perhaps even more, over the summer and fall to balance the budget. I don't need a reply from the commissioner, but I think that's where we may be heading.
Okay, thank you, Representative Pulaski. Representative Albright. Representative Albright.
Commissioner, I have a couple of follow-ons to Representative Pulaski. With regard to the budget reserves, are you aware of specific events that have to happen that would trigger your ability to utilize the budget reserves?
Commissioner?
Yes, Representative, Mr. Chair. So the statute's fairly clear about that. So if you look at statute 16A.152, budget reserve and cash flow accounts, if you go to subdivision 4, well, let's start with subdivision 3. Subdivision 3 talks about the use of the budget reserve. Subdivision 2 is that wonderful place where we used to be, where there was a positive budget variance projected. And so, but if you get to subdivision 3 and 4, it talks about when there's a negative budgetary balance. So subdivision 3 talks about that the use of the budget reserve should be governed by principles based on the full economic cycle rather than the budget cycle. The budget reserve may be used when a negative budgetary balance is projected and when objective measures such as reduced growth in total wages, retail sales, or employment reflect downturns in the state's economy, clearly given guidance that the fact that if you're going to project a budget deficit, it needs to be based on objective matters, and those are some of those that it should be based on. And then subdivision 4 talks about the reduction. So subdivision 4A says that if the commissioner determines that probable receipts from the general fund will be less than anticipated and that the amount available for the remainder of the biennium will be less than needed, the commissioner shall, with the approval of the governor and after consulting the Legislative Advisory Commission, reduce the amount in the budget reserve account as needed to balance expenditures with revenue. So it's a fairly tight process where you determine if there's a need, if there is in fact a negative budgetary balance, and then number two, that you only use the reserve necessary to restore balance. So it depends obviously on what the size of that deficit might be in terms of how much you would use it and under what conditions. Does that answer your question, Sam?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner, you mentioned that the instigation of those chapters in the code are based upon a forecast of an estimate budget deficit. When would you, the two-part question, the first is, when would you request that a new budget forecast be completed? And then, what constitutes or what would create that triggering mechanism for a new budget forecast to be completed? And then, by your own words, you're suggesting that the budget reserve would be used or available to you based upon a forecast rather than an actual deficit? Or at what point? What's the inflection point for which that decision would be made?
Mr. Chair, Representative, it's not based on the forecast. So let's back up a little bit. It is based upon a budget projection. So we normally use forecasts. So typically in November and February, we have a forecast, and at that time, we make a budget projection as well. The statute provides for a budget determination based on these objective measures. It does not require a forecast to trigger a budget projection with a deficit in it. So clearly, if we did a budget projection in May, for example, and it showed a deficit, that would provide the statutory authority to use a reserve. Obviously, if we did another forecast in July or August or whenever, that too would provide the basis, the objective basis to use to solve whatever deficit was at that particular time. So it's not a forecast that triggers the use of the deficit. It's a budget projection showing a deficit based on economic objective measures.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner Franz, could you remind me who is on the LAC?
Mr. Chair, Representative, it depends. If I recall, it's one of those that the membership is determined by the nature of the request, and typically, in this particular case, though, it would probably, if I recall correctly, it would be the speaker, the chair of the Ways and Means, and it would include the majority leader of the Senate and the chair of the Finance. But, Mr. Chair, there's two other members. Do you recall who they are?
Those are floating members, if I recall. So depending on the issue that's before us, it would be...
I remember it's the minority leader in both houses. So it'd be the chair of the speaker and the minority leader and the chair of the Ways and Means. The majority leader, the minority leader and the chair of the finance committee if it's a finance related issue. You're right, it could change if it was a different subject matter.
It depends. Like if you had human services, you would perhaps have the chair of human services, finance would be one of the members for that particular meeting then.
Right.
Any further questions, Representative Albright?
Just maybe a clarifying one for the commissioner. So is it the position of the commissioner that they would utilize the funds within the budget reserve and then inform the LAC of the actions taken, or is it in consultation with agreement by the LAC before that action is taken?
Commissioner? Mr. Chair, yeah, Representative. So it's pretty clear that if there is a deficit determined, that the commissioner shall, with the approval of the governor and after consulting the Legislative Advisory Commission, then have the authority to reduce the budget reserve account as needed to balance the expenditures. So that's what the statute says. That's the minimum required. I'm not saying that's necessarily all that we would do, clearly, but it that's the minimum required.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. And Senator Firtas.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner Franz. Just to kind of finish up a little bit on aviation metaphor, if you would, it's often been said that if you have more drag than lift, you won't gain altitude. In fact, you won't even take off. And if too much drag continues, you'll crash. And I think what Representative Garofalo was alluding to was much of what all of us have probably heard from many of our constituents, concern about the economic shutdown. My question relates specifically to the extension of the governor's powers. And should it, and isn't it, would it not be most appropriate that any of his executive orders that are given be aligned with the amount of power or the time duration of the power that he has under any other further extensions? Right now, we have some situations that executive orders were declared and given timelines that went beyond this most recent extension that occurred today. So what are your feelings or thoughts about making sure with regard to the legislature coming towards the end of a session that any executive orders align with his authority to give them?
Representative, Mr. Chair, well, I think one of the keys is that when you lay out the powers that the governor has in the executive order based upon the declaration of a peacetime emergency and the length of that. So now we know that the length of that has been determined to go to at least May 13th. Based upon the extension today, you know, some of the orders, any timelines that go beyond that, I mean, you clearly want the orders to typically last during the existence of the peacetime emergency, as you suggest. But from a practical point of view, we also need to give people some advance notice of some issues. So I think the key would be trying to make sure that the order that was issued under the current peacetime order that had been extended and was operational, and that those orders would be consistent with that peacetime emergency for that time period. But you know, you're going to have some situations that may go beyond that, but I think that's something we'll just have to deal with, and we'll have to see on May 13th whether those peacetime orders or the peacetime declaration continues.
And Mr. Chair?
Representative Rudas.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And my other question relates to the question about the budget reserve. You know, from my perspective, it's taken nearly 10 years to build the budget reserve up to an amount which is considered to be fully funded. And that's something that has been at the hard work and effort of Minnesota taxpayers. And, you know, something that we're probably all agree is a very strong fiscal position to be in with regard to managing states' finances. But with regard to the statutory provisions that you had already enumerated, which gives you authority to trigger access to some of those funds, would it not be appropriate at the same time to be considering some form of equal reduction in previously authorized spending to kind of match the amount of money that's needed to be taken from the reserve account. I think it's important to not spend this thing down all at once if that circumstances seem to indicate that it's necessary. And I know that government spending is going to help get the economy get going back. I understand those components of it, but you know, essential services and some of the things we do that are maybe beyond essential might be certainly worthy of reevaluation. We've long been wanting to continue programs that work and maybe end programs that don't work or are not operating most efficiently. So I guess the summary of my question is, wouldn't it be appropriate to start talking about things we need to cut with regard to spending as much as what additional funds we need may need to access? Thank you for your reply.
Commissioner.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative. Well, I think it's incumbent upon us to be smart about everything we do. I mean, to take your point, I do think that we don't take anything for granted. I mean, goodness. It was, what, 6 weeks ago that I stood up in front of the public and you all said we have a $1.5 billion surplus. Budget sound and the economy looks good. Oh, yeah, there's this coronavirus thing out there we need to watch. Well, look what's happened in just a little over 6 weeks. So you're right. Everything has to be examined carefully. But I will say, though, one of the things that we've been working really hard on this last 6 weeks has been saving lives. I mean, the governor has made it clear that his directive and his primary directive is to engage and use these funds that the legislature has appropriated to the administration to save lives, to increase capacity with hospital beds, IC units, to increase supplies, PPE, all wherever we can, and to also increase testing. So those are the things that we're trying to do, and we don't want to let up at all on that. And we hope to get some federal monies to help with that. But at the same time, I have to tell you that in order to maintain these priority services, we have a lot of 24/7 operations. We have a lot of public facing situations where we've been able to convert a lot of those to internet connections and other ways of doing business. But we also have a lot of folks supporting that, those people in those roles. And I think it's really hard to say at this point that we need to start cutting without knowing exactly where we are in terms of revenues coming in and the expenditures that we need to make. And one of the worst things we want to do is cut the very core out of the support services that we provide for government licensing, inspections, and other things that make our workforce and our workplace work. So that's a delicate balance, right? And I think that what we want to do is to make sure that we do that carefully. So we initiated a partial hiring freeze. It must have been 2 weeks ago. I forget the exact date. And at that time, we took about a third of the current open jobs off the board, so to speak, and said we're only going to hire for priority services. Now, we've expanded that hiring freeze to make sure that we fill in behind and we have the people necessary in the 24/7 operations that are out there who have been really great heroes and going to work every day under really difficult circumstances. They deserve our respect and admiration. But we're trying to do that and review what they're doing, making sure that we support that. But we're also looking at ways to make those kind of cuts that make sense. For example, there are some agencies that are partially or fully supported by revenues, and some of those revenues have stopped. Well, that's where we're looking first. You know, what do we do in those situations for those agencies or commissions or boards or different funds that operate off of revenues, solely off of revenues? Well, those are the ones we have to look at first, because you're right, you don't want to drag on the current budget from those situations. But on the other hand, that's part of what we're going to try to do between now and May, is provide some better insight for you all in terms of what is the budget look like? What does the spending look like, given the fact that we're doing a couple things at the same time? We're trying to fight the COVID-19 response. We're trying to manage operations as they currently exist. And we're trying to plan for what does this mean over the next 6 months or a year. I'm not saying we can't do that. I'm just saying that's a lot of stuff going on at one time. And we want to make sure that when we make moves, they're strategic. They're focused on making sure that we have the resources necessary to save lives, number one, to help this economy recover, number two. So your point's well taken, and we do expect to look at everything. And that's why the governor today announced I think I mentioned earlier that we're going to prepare a budget projection for the legislature in early May. He announced that the statewide hiring freeze that we have in place now across state government that require only hiring for those priority services, like in corrections and troopers and that sort of a thing. And any exceptions have to be approved by the Commissioner of Management and Budget to make sure that we have some control on that process. And he also announced that he and his chief of staff and the 24 cabinet commissioners are taking a 10% pay cut for the rest of the year. Some of these are small steps in the sense of total dollars, but I think they show that we're seriously looking at all avenues and trying to make sure that we prepare a budget projection for you in May that takes a look at all the different aspects of running the state enterprise, which is so intertwined both with the COVID response and with keeping the economy supported. Thank you.
Any further questions, Representative Hurtas?
Mr. Chair, no, thank you. And thank you, Commissioner Franz, for everything that you're having to do in under difficult times. Thank you for that.
Thank you. Okay.
Thank you, Representative Lieberly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So a couple quick things. One, a little quick response to Representative Hurtas asking about the executive order and when things end. Some of the legislation that we've been passing in the Health and Human Service area certainly is really tracking pretty closely with the executive orders, except that much of the time we're including an additional 60 days for things to wind down after the order terminates. So I don't know really in terms of the executive order itself, if that is just, it sort of ends when it ends and then everything under it maybe would go away. But if in fact that's what happens, it's a good reason for us to include in legislation. You know, it's better if we can do this in legislation than by executive order. And then we can include a little bit of a cushion on the end, because some of these things that are being done just don't end on a dime. They need a little time to wind down with billing and whatever. I mean, we're talking about, you know, services for human beings. So I just wanted to put that out there as information. But my question really went back to what Representative Pawlowski was talking about. And asking about what would happen if we had a deficit and so on. Doesn't the governor still have a power of unallotment? I'm remembering back to when Governor Pawlenty used this. It was, of course, very controversial when the governor starts unallotting things that you just budgeted for. But I think the governor still has that power. I just wanted to ask the commissioner, I know he'd be very reluctant to use it, and anything we can do together as a legislature and with the executive branch is going to be much preferable. But if push came to shove, could he still do that?
Well, thank you, Representative, Mr. Chair. Yes, Subdivision 4, if you keep reading in Subdivision 4, you have a very good memory. So I only went as far as what I hope we have to do, right? And so if the if there's an addition, so Subdivision 4B, says if there's an additional deficit, meaning going beyond the use of the reserve, if there's an additional deficit with with the approval of the governor after consulting the LAC, it should be made up by reducing unexpended allotments or any prior appropriation or transfer. So the commissioner is empowered to defer or suspend prior statutorily created obligation, which would prevent affecting such reductions. But if the commissioner in Subdivision C determines that the probable receipts for any fund will be less than anticipated and the amount available for the remainder of the term for the appropriation or any allotment period will be less than needed, the commissioner shall notify the agency concerned and then reduce the amount allotted or to be allotted so as to prevent a deficit. So you're right. That power is there. Let's hope we don't even have to talk about doing that. Let's hope that through the process of working through the budget reserve we have, we can solve these problems and not need that. But yes, it's there in an emergency. Right.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I have a question on behalf of Representative Hansen. He's having some problems for one reason or another getting in. And so Commissioner Representative Hansen wanted to know your thoughts on the dedicated funds, what the impact would be there, legacy LCCMR?
Mr. Chair, yes. And thank you, Representative, for asking that question. I think that the one of the things that we do have to look at in the short term are those funds. So many of those funds are supported by direct appropriations from the sales tax. As you recall, the some of those funds were set up with a direct appropriation from the increase in the sales tax a number of years ago, before my time working in the state government. And they will have to also be balanced. So we are now going through that process, examining all of those different funds that are supported by legacy funds or other revenues. As I mentioned earlier, those are the places where we're looking right now, because they're in danger right now of running out of having fewer funds than they anticipated. So they're now going to need to rebudget and refigure out what kind of a budget do they have for the remainder of the biennium, given the fact that the sales tax has dropped because sales activity has dropped. So yes, those situations, Representative Hansen, we do need to review and take a look at those and make recommendations.
Okay, thank you. On behalf of Representative Hansen and myself, I spent a number of years on LCCMR, and we did have to make some adjustments back then when we had revenue shortfalls. What I want to do is we've got two additional people that have questions, Commissioner. I was told prior to the meeting that you and Dr. Kalamakidis had some time constraints. How are we doing relative to you remaining?
What time I'm looking? Oh, it's 3:40. Yeah, I need to get off about 4:05 or 4:10. I can be a little bit late for this other call, but I need to get on another call in about 5 or 10 minutes.
Okay, then the two that I still have with their hands up are Representative Torkelson and Representative Vogel. And if you can each be relatively brief so you can both get your questions in while the commissioner is still with us. Representative Torkelson.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Commissioner, for being with us. I'll make this very brief. One of the bills that we still talk about quite a bit among the legislators is the bonding bill, capital investment. Will the governor revise his position on the capital investment bill?
Commissioner?
Well, thank you, Representative and Mr. Chair. Excellent question. As you know, we talked a little bit about this at the forecast on February 27th, and we've talked about it several times since. You know, clearly one of the things about the bonding bill that's unique is the fact that it takes, you know, 1 to 2 to 3, 4 years sometimes for it to be fully implemented, because most of you know that when we pass the bonding bill, we don't sell all of those bonds that next summer or this coming summer. If we pass the bonding bill, we would sell some of those bonds, the ones that we would need the cash flow on for the next year. You never want to sell more than you're actually going to use throughout the next year, because we typically go to market once a year, depending upon other factors. And, you know, the market situation is one thing. You just have to all admit, whatever we decide to do on a bonding bill, we're going to have to all realize going into this that if something happens to the bond market this summer, we might have to delay, even if we did pass a bonding bill, depending on the market. So the market is always the key. We have to follow what's available in the market. We wouldn't want to do anything that was foolish from an economic point of view. But on the other hand, the counter-cyclical nature of a bonding bill is quite attractive right now, given what might happen with the unemployment over the next year or two. So that makes the bonding bill even more attractive for us. The key, I think, you have to look at, I'll let Dr. Kalamakidis fill in here. The key you have to look at is, what is that additional spending that you would do this biennium? And I don't at the top of my head have what that is for the governor's bonding bill proposal for 2021, but do you want to commit to that, assuming you do sell the bonds, or you may be in a deficit situation? And if you are in a deficit situation, do you want to use some of the reserve for that? Because you're competing with other things at that point. So the bonding dollars do compete with other parts of the budget, because you cannot not pay those debts, right? So once you're in. Although, like I said, there are times when we can decide whether or not to sell or not. Dr. Kalamakidis, you have anything you want to add?
Dr. Kalamakidis?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thanks, Commissioner, and thanks, Representative, for the question. I agree with what the commissioner said, that, you know, it was mentioned earlier that the state can't borrow for operational expenses generally, and so we don't have an opportunity to stimulate the economy by deficit spending the way the federal government does. But one of the ways we can offer some stimulus, especially with lots of people out of work, is with a bonding bill, because that's one of the ways that we can, that's the way that we can borrow. And it's unfortunate that in this situation, that one of the many things that's going on in this current economic climate is volatility in the muni market. And so that interest rate situation is much more volatile than we have faced before, even with the Federal Reserve lowering the target for the federal funds rate, because states are facing this difficult budget situation. Their bonds are, the interest rates that we can get on bonds is not what it should be given our financial situation. So, I agree. It's countercyclical. It's a good idea to put people to work. It will have an impact on the budget, and that will compete with other needs as resources become more scarce, as revenues contract.
Okay, any follow-up? Well, our next person is Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the commissioner, just clarifying on the difference between the powers and the emergency declaration. When the emergency declaration ends, do the powers end at that point, or is there some statutory thing that says that they go on until some point in time when they were made to be carried out?
Commissioner?
Representative and Mr. Chair, you have just reached the end of my legal knowledge, and I don't know the exact answer to that question. I know that the Governor's Counsel, Carl Procaccini, has worked on how to make sure that works out and the timing of when the powers end and the declaration end. But I haven't been tracking on how that comes to an end. I'm sorry, I just don't know the answer to that.
We had one more hand that went up. If you can be very quick, Representative Krisha, we have to let the commissioner go. He's got a conference call, I guess, that's coming up. So, Representative Krisha.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to Commissioner. Just very quickly, looking at the school budgets and how the prolonged shutdown is affecting them and their possibly with the executive order heading into a deficit spending situation, depending on how all the costs come in. How is the governor looking at that? Is there a supplemental budget that would be proposed, or is he just going to allow the executive order to continue to push schools into local decisions where they're going to have to manage their expenses and their people?
Commissioner?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative. Yeah, good question. Well, part of that has to be decided based upon the money in the federal bill for K-12 education. As you know, there are a bunch of buckets in the federal bill for higher education, for K-12, for mass transit, for homeless shelters, for food issues. So anyway, the point being that when we get the guidance on what that means and how does the federal fund dollars flow through to the local schools, that's one thing we need to sort out. We're told we'd get more guidance on these funds today, and now it looks like it may be this Friday. So that's part of the answer to the question. Well, what support, if any, are they going to get from the federal government? The number two does become, well, if in fact they're having those revenue problems, and we're going to have to sit down with them and figure out what does that mean for them for the rest of for this year and as they go into the next fiscal year. I mean, that when you look at it, Representative Krisha, that's really what we have to do with all the different funds. We'll be talking to local units of government, to school districts, and to everyone about how is this going to affect everybody, because we're all right now in a situation where we're losing funds fast in different ways. So we'll have to look at that. I don't have the specifics on that now. And part of it is I want to know what the federal government funds are going to do for K through 12.
Okay, I want to let you, Commissioner Sy, would just say thank you to you, Commissioner Franz, as well as Dr. Kalambakidis for your presentation today. I do want to have Bill Marks make a quick comment about federal funds. And I think with your comments, Commissioner, about we have to get more information maybe as soon as next Friday about the guidance of how those funds should be spent. We can perhaps have a further discussion at our next Ways and Means hearing. But Mr. Marks, are you still with us?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Goodbye.
Yes. Yep, bye. Mr. Marks?
Mr. Chair, members, there were two handouts that were provided to the committee, and I believe are posted on the website. One is a list of the federal funds that we've identified. This is largely through information from the Federal Funds Information Service, or FFIS, as listed on the page. And they're organized by the U.S. Departments, so Treasury's first, Department of Education, and so on. And there's a list of the dollar amounts that FFIS has estimated Minnesota will receive under those various programs in there. So just that's provided for you to look through. The fiscal staff for the various committees are probably taking a closer look at this. And as was mentioned, we don't have a lot of information on some of these yet as to how the what the federal government's guidance is on how they can be used. In some cases, the federal law specified how they would be used, but where there's more flexibility, there may be some guidance coming from the federal agencies on that. So there are three pages there that's provided. That list is also on the website of the Fiscal Analysis Department and will be updated as we get more information on that. And then the second handout is a memo from me to the committee about appropriation of federal funds. And I just lays out five different methods under which federal funds are appropriated. I'll make the point that many of them are done under a statutory appropriation and involves advice from the Legislative Advisory Commission. But there are some other methods on here, and that information is available here. And I can answer any questions now or by email about it.
Okay. Do we have any questions of Mr. Marks at this point? Well, thank you, Mr. Marks. And for the benefit of the committee, I think we'll probably at an upcoming meeting when we get some more information from the Treasury Department on the use of federal funds, have further discussion on that. We have one remaining item, and that's the approval of the minutes. I put that at the end of the agenda because we knew that the Commissioner Franz had some time constraints. So is Representative Olson with us?
I am, Mr. Chair, and I move the adoption of the minutes from March 9th, 2020.
Okay, that motion is before us, and as I mentioned at the beginning, any action that we take has to be by roll call. So if the clerk would take the roll on the approval of the minutes.
Representative Carlson?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Garofalo?
Yes.
Representative Albright?
I think that should come to play. How we manage that.
Representative Bernardi?
Aye.
Representative Davids?
Aye.
Representative Dabney? Representative Drazkowski? Representative Eklund?
Aye.
Representative Hamilton?
Aye.
Representative Hansen? Representative Hausman? Representative Hertas?
Aye.
Representative Hornstein?
Aye.
Representative Kreisha?
Aye.
Representative Liebling?
Aye.
Representative Lilly?
Aye.
Representative Long?
Aye.
Representative Mariani?
Aye.
Representative Marquardt?
Aye.
Representative Nelson?
Aye.
Representative Noor?
Aye.
Representative Pilowski?
Aye.
Representative Coppi?
Aye.
Representative Schumacher?
Aye.
Representative Scott?
Aye.
Representative Turkelson?
Aye.
Representative Vogel?
Aye.
Representative Wagenius?
Aye.
24 ayes, zero nays.
Okay, that's the approval of the minutes. Thank you, Ms. Sparkman. And with that, our business is complete, but I do want to thank everybody, especially the staff that helped put this together and coached the chair quite a bit on how this was, the whole system would work. And I thought it went quite well today. So I'd like to particularly acknowledge Nancy Conley and her work putting this together, as well as Ms. Sparkman, our committee clerk. They spent a fair amount of time with the chair to make sure I knew what I was doing. And I thought it went well. So I'd like to thank everybody. And with that, meeting adjourned.